Well, brethren, first we'll just summarize a little bit what we learned yesterday, what we discussed yesterday. Now, let's see, this is not operating yet. This is what we went through yesterday, the 12 chapters that are preliminary in the book of Acts. Nice to see you, Carol. How are you? And I say it's preliminary because preliminary to the services of Paul that are primarily what we were going to look at. Now, Paul is mentioned here. He was converted, as recorded in the 9th chapter in 34 A.D. approximately. And this deals with the 12 chapters of the apostolic experiences. And then after that, we pretty much have Paul's experiences after that through chapter 26. But there's even some allegorical meaning to some of these experiences. Now, we just went through, I'll just review them quickly. Chapter 1, you have the question that the disciples asked Jesus before he was taken. Will you at this time restore again the kingdom to Israel? And the famous text we all know, the heavens must retain him until the times of restoration, are really what they pieced together. They understood that since he was going and he'd be back, that's when he would restore again the kingdom to Israel. And that's why we see now the Lord has returned, Israel is being restored. That all makes sense. Adam is back to the grave, but that's not what Peter was talking about. He was talking about Israel's restoring as the kingdom, and then subsequently through that, of course, Adam would come back and all the rest. In second chapter, we have Pentecost. That was the third hour, the same hour Jesus was put on the cross. He had to die on the cross for the Jews. He had to die at the ninth hour for everybody. And the ninth hour is when that lame man was healed, who was lame from birth, perhaps representing us Gentiles, even though that man himself wasn't a Gentile. Chapter 4, the apostles end up in jail. They're freed. And then they go out and continue to witness just like they're supposed to, and 5,000 was the total number of men in the congregation by then. And then it continues to say they were augmented and augmented and augmented. We don't have other numbers, but I would imagine you have a community of close to 10,000 or so by, you know, just a couple of years into the Christian era. It was really growing rapidly. Well, that leads to problems, of course, and they had the problem of supporting everybody. And because it was kind of a community arrangement. And that's when Ananias and Sapphira brought some gift of land and sold it and gave the apostles the money, but they weren't honest about what they were doing. And integrity and honesty was shown to be vital. These are the principles of Christian conduct that we have to abide by, and I think a good stern lesson was given at the very beginning. The apostles ended up in jail again because of their growing popularity. I mean, it says that people would just seek to be in a place where Peter would walk by and cast a shadow over them because he was in such repute and because of the miracles he was able to accomplish for the healing. So they ended up in jail again. And that night, an angel took them out of jail. And the next morning, they're ready to bring them for a trial. And they went to find him. And the doors are locked and the guards are out there and there's nobody inside. And so the Lord was just giving them every irrefutable evidence that this was a godly work. So they went out and preached again, and then they captured him a third time now. And Gamaliel said, no, just be careful what you do here. And the wisdom of Gamaliel, I think, seeped down into his disciple Paul. Didn't come out right away, but I think as years went by, he appreciated the wisdom that he had learned there. Then we led to some problems in the church for which they had to elect deacons, all of which seemed to have Grecianized names, showing that they were very wise to establish deacons that would serve the Grecianized widows in the church. It's, you know, it's always good if somebody's complaining, there's a real cause for complaint, that you bend over backward to satisfy that. Now, sometimes that means the squeaky wheel gets the oil, you know, but it works okay. You have to exercise some wisdom there. Stephen then ended up in martyrdom, at the hands of the Jewish Sanhedrin, and I think that's representative that the first stage of the church would experience the difficulty and persecution by Israel. As Paul said, Ishmael is persecuting Isaac. And then in chapter 8, the gospel goes from Jerusalem already to Judea, Samaria, and to the other most parts of the earth, just like Jesus said it would. Then Paul enters the picture in chapter 9, about 34 AD. He spends 3 years in Damascus before he comes to Jerusalem. He was let down, escaping a plot for his death after that 3 years in Damascus. Comes to Jerusalem, and there they also plotted to kill him. And the Lord said, well, I'll send you far away and give you a ministry to the Gentiles. So Paul left. After he left, I believe, the flow of the narrative is, we have chapter 10. Cornelius was converted, and Peter was the agent for that. He had one of those keys of heaven he used there. And in chapter 11, Peter comes back to Jerusalem, and the Jewish brethren in Jerusalem confront him about this Gentile, of participation in things of the Jewish Messiah. And he relates the whole experience, how he had a dream, don't call the unclean things, unclean, call them clean now. And Cornelius had a vision by an angel, and the whole thing, it all happened at the ninth hour, just the hour that Jesus died on the cross, which he had to do for all of mankind, including the Gentiles. So those times of blessing are significant. And then at Antioch, the Gentile people began more and more to be inducted into Christianity. They were first called Christians there. I think we're getting now as a picture of what would happen in the second phase of the church, where the gospel would primarily go to Gentiles after the Christian, after the Jewish harvest was over. Barnabas is set up from Jerusalem to go to Antioch and just report on what's happening here. When he sees what's going on, he says, well, I know who can help us here. That would be Paul. So he goes up to Tarsus and brings Paul back. And for about a full year, they're in Antioch doing productive work. And then there's a famine that is approaching. Well, I think some of our discussion after our formal services yesterday brought to the attention that that might represent the third phase of the church. You have the Jewish influx. Then you have the Gentile influx in the second phase of the church. And then the third phase of the church, when Christianity became popular under Constantine, corruption came in, and that's where you have the third seal, the famine. The rider on the black horse with a pair of scales saying, we got to measure out the food very, very carefully. And if you look in Lamentations, that black horse, is the color of associated symbolically with famine. And you find that in Lamentations, where that color is intermixed with the concept of famine. And so then in chapter 12, we have, we already had Stephen dying, picturing the Jewish persecution. Now we have James dying by the hand of Herod, not the Jews, but Herod, Roman power, showing that the second phase of the church would be in Smyrna, persecution by Rome against the church. Then he takes Peter, but Peter is freed. The iron gates open up. Iron is a symbol of Rome. You find that back in the four world empires. That fourth beast, Rome, had great iron teeth. And in the Nebuchadnezzar's vision, it was the iron legs represent Rome. The iron doors of Rome swing open, and that persecution stops in the third phase of the church. And at that time, that's when Herod dies. He's struck down by the Lord, and he's eaten up by worms. Herod, the political power, may be showing the fact that the pagan Roman Empire that so persecuted the church, God would deal with and judge. And that's in Revelation. That's the great mountain burning with fire cast into the sea. I think Herod's death shows the death of pagan Rome. And we have a little mention at the end of chapter 12 that John Mark, good morning, Jerry, John Mark went with Barnabas, and John Mark is going to be associated with Paul and Barnabas on the first missionary tour. Now, we have three missionary tours that come after this. That's chapters 13 down through about 21. And there's a very easy rule of thumb to remember where to find things in the book of Acts. It works pretty good. Not 100%, but pretty good. How many apostles were there? 12 apostles, okay. So the first 12 chapters take you through the apostolic works. And then from thereafter, you get onto Paul's work. Paul had three missionary journeys, and each one of them consumes about three chapters. So you have 13, 14, 15. That's the first missionary tour. 16, 17, 18, That's the second missionary tour. 1920 and 21, the third missionary tour. And that takes us to Paul's visit to Jerusalem for the last time, where he's going to be captured by a riot that ensues when people identify him as somebody, and they charge him with defiling the temple. They're all wrong. Everything he was doing was exactly the opposite. It was trying to show his opinion about the sanctity of the temple. But he was, anyway, taken by the mob, rescued by the governor, taken for protective custody, remained in jail for 2 years on his way to Rome. And that takes us to chapter 27. 27 and 28 are Paul's voyage to Rome. And this is why the whole subject of Acts was so interesting to us, because of Brother Ray Luke's talk on this so many years ago. And we're going to suggest that Acts 27 picks up the thread of thought at the end of the age and the harvest, when the church is on their way to the center of world authority. In this case, pictured by Rome, but picturing the establishment of Christ's kingdom. So chapter 27 is really about our day. Chapter 28 is really about the kingdom that unfolds after the gospel age harvest is finished. So chapter 27 has got 44 verses. Take a little while to get through, but it's just really packed with details that affect us in our experience today. Bill?
I just wonder if we could go back to number 8 there.
Yeah.
Do you look at that as a parallel or a fulfillment of Matthew 24, we're getting a little bit off the subject, but 24:14, and this gospel of the kingdom shall be preached in all the world for a witness? I mean, would you look at that as 1845 years different, like it started here and then it expanded, and the fulfillment of that would be 1845 years later with the Matthew idea there? I don't know.
Yeah, I think so. I think all of Matthew 24 has a double fulfillment. One level leads you to the end of the Jewish age, and one level leads you to the end of the gospel age. Now, it's true that because of the work of Paul and of the apostles that went out, all the civilized world at that time had a witness before the end of the Jewish temple came. But it's also true that on the expanded picture, the whole world has had a witness before the end of the gospel age. And that witness picked up, especially after the 1260 days when the Bibles began streaming back into popular use. And yeah, I think that text takes you to the end of the Jewish harvest and also takes you to the opening of the gospel age harvest.
Would you have a date on this one exactly, Matthew 24:14?
Well, I would say the end came when they saw the Roman legions on the horizon in 66 A.D. And as far as our end of the age, I think the end came at the harvest, starting with 1874. That's my opinion about the text. Okay, so anything? Any other questions or comments on any of these episodes? We spent a couple hours on it yesterday. Even at that, it's kind of rushed to go through 12 chapters. But that's the background, and now we want to get into Paul's experience itself. Well, I'll just make this observation, that Paul, in 34 A.D., spent 3 years. That takes you to 37 A.D. And then 15 years later, he came back to Jerusalem for the Council of Judea. And that takes you to 37 and 15. That's about 51 or 52 A.D., that gives you the Council of Judea. And that's the way you can piece together the history of the timeline in the book of Acts. By that 3 years Paul spent at Damascus, and then 15 years later when he came to Jerusalem for the council. The council was all about, what are we going to have the Gentiles do? How much of the law do they have to observe or not observe? We'll get into that maybe tomorrow when we get through the missionary tours. Oh, yeah, okay. Now, then we're going to go on. We're going to go on to the harvest, and here we're going to just show you an outline of world events that have transpired that we just simply have observed. That's all, just observed. We observed that for the first 40 years of the harvest, we had a going out of the truth message that was very, very significant. It took the Christian world by storm, in my opinion. I read a little bit about, when you read a little bit about the history of the early truth movement, and you see the ecclesias began just multiplying almost spontaneously. And it was just a matter of him trying to keep up with the push of people and their interest. Now, when was the first volume actually distributed and published?
Do you know that?
1886. Well, you know, the first volume came after so many ecclesias were already in operation. We've had the volume 1 with us for all our life, so you don't think about the fact that most of the brethren in the ecclesias that started early in the truth didn't even have that. It was a matter of catch-up work trying to get this volume out, and he was a little delayed because of the press of activity. And then volume 2 and volume 4. Volume 6 didn't come out until, 1904? Something like that? And that means that the brethren who were there when Brother Russell died in 1916 had the complete set of volumes for 12 years, and that's it. Now, most of you have been in the truth for more than 12 years. Longer, two or three times that, and gone through the volumes two or three times over the years. I mean, we've been in our class through the volumes 4 times probably since I was a kid. And it's just part of our culture. Well, the brethren in the early truth movement, they didn't even have the complete set for more than about a dozen years before Brother Russell passed away. Just a little historical perspective here. After 1914, then began World War I, followed by World War II, punctuated between them by the Great Depression. That's simply what happened. Those are earth-shattering, remarkable events. After World War II, we entered the Cold War, and that's the time when the colonial empires began to dissolve and disintegrate. You remember Jesus said, when you see the fig tree, Israel, that's after World War II, and then all the trees sprout, well, that's after World War II. That's where Indonesia, Indochina, Africa, all of the Third World began to sprout and become independent rather than part of colonial empires of the Western world. And then, after the Cold War ended, and you live and learn. I didn't even know the Cold War was ever going to end until Armageddon, back in those days. But in 1989, that's when the Soviet Union began to break up. It formally didn't go by their boards until 1991. But 1989 was about when everything began to fall apart. And then we entered a new era. And it was only just a couple of years later that we ran full force into the Islam problem. There were problems some already, but full force we came to the first Gulf War. Was that 1991 about? Or 1990? Somewhere in there. 1991? January 15th. Okay, just at the border. Thank you. Just happened to know that date. Okay. So, about that time, we had also problems. Well, not quite problems yet with the economy. It was going to surge for another decade. But hitting the end of the 1900s and the beginning of the 2000s, we had a stock market debacle. And then on 9/11 2001, it took another leg down. It already had been collapsing. Then it took another leg severely down. And I think we're seeing now economic woes strike the Western world. Now after, half a decade or more, then we hit this real estate problem, and we're not out of that yet. We're still mired there. And these things are going to come in waves, and it's going to be a while before this all takes place. But now, with the perspective we're looking at now, I think we see the economy and Islam as two sides of a problem, and I think that's going to take us finally to Armageddon. Now, you just happen to see that there are 7 items listed here. Now, I don't know what to say this is for today. It just seemed very natural to me, but these 7, in my opinion, do actually correlate with the 7 plagues of Revelation. That's what we find in Revelation. There will be 7 judgments that lead you to the kingdom. And I think these are very natural series of 7 events that do take us there. The very first plague in Revelation was upon Christian people who worshipped the beast or his image. But it wasn't a deadly plague. It was just kind of an open wound, a sore they couldn't really respond to. That's the way the truth movement was. Second plague, deadly. Every living thing in the sea died. Well, that's a deadly plague, and I won't go through all the plagues. But I just think that these are related. Now, in Exodus, you have a series of plagues, the 7 last of the 10 there. What happened at to distinguish the 7 last from the first 3 in Exodus? Something happened to distinguish them. Cheryl?
Well, the first 3 were on everybody. The last 7 were only on the Egyptians, not on the Jews.
So there's a cleavage made. And where's that cleavage for us? I think it's the beginning of the harvest up here. Come out of her, my people. Thereafter, the 7 last plagues should be on Christendom, and we shouldn't be affected directly because we're out of Christendom. And I think there's the distinction that shows the 7 last plagues begin at the harvest and go forward all the way to Armageddon and then finally, of course, introducing the kingdom. Now, we've got this segregated into four main parts, and that's because we also have another representation of the time of trouble, and that's way back in the time of Elijah. You'll find this in 1 Kings chapter 18 and chapter 19. And maybe you remember that after the 1260 years had passed, 1260 days rather, of drought, takes you to 1799, which should mark some of these down. Then Elijah had to flee for his life. And I'll put this up here. 1799 comes. Elijah has to flee because Jezebel is going to have a little resurgence, a little bit. He flees and he's so discouraged, he finds a juniper tree, rests under it, and he says, "Oh, just take my life. I'm not worthy of anything better than my father's." I still remember a talk by Brother Seclemian years ago in California. He said if Elijah was really serious about that, all he had to do was just wait for Jezebel's men to catch up to him, and they'd take his life just like he wanted. But of course, you know, when you're discouraged, you give vent sometimes to things that aren't really what you want. He didn't really want to die yet, and it was premature. So it says that he was fed by an angel, and then something happened to him after he was fed by the angel. What did Elijah do after he was first fed by the angel? It's counterintuitive, not what you might suspect. Remember the episode? He laid down and he slept. And then the angel says, the journey is too great for you. You have to rise up and eat again. So he had a second meal provided by the angel. And I think these are two feedings of the Lord's people after 1799. And the first feeding was in the Millerite movement, the Adventist movement. And then after that, you had a feeding of present truth. And it says he went in the strength of that food for 40 days. And that 40 days, I think, represents from 1874 to 1914. Now, this is a predicate for Acts. You know, we're rushing through this a little bit because it's just a predicate for getting into the Acts text. But that's 40 days represents the 40 years taking up to 1914. And that's where Elijah sees the wind, the earthquake, and the fire. And after that, the still small voice representing the kingdom. So the wind would represent the winds of war, World War I and World War II. So it takes us through this whole area. And after that, after World War II, the earthquake would be the disruption of all the old colonial powers. And that's what we've seen since World War II. Now, we found India got their liberty in what year? Do you recall? About there, 47, 48. Israel got their liberty in 48. And then the French colonies in Indochina began to break up in the 60s. And Africa, many other countries came to light in the 60s. And so there was a lot of activity here.
And then the Soviet disunion.
Yeah, that's
89.
Okay, that's right. That's right. And I think that's the last breakup that finally ends the earthquake phase. Now, I should have put another line in here, I see. Because that's should have segregated that earthquake phase. And that would take us to about 1989. When the earthquake phase, I think, has come to a climax. And then shortly thereafter, you had the Islamic insurgency rise, and you had economic problems about a decade later. And I think the fire, we often say fire is a picture of anarchy. And I often wondered, I mean, for years, I thought, okay, you got World War I and World War II. That's decades long of war. And then you had decades long of the earthquake. And then you have, just a brief 1 or 2 years of anarchy at the very end? It was out of proportion. But I now think that fire of anarchy is really the Islamic insurgency that lasts for decades, just like the others do. So I think this is in the right order of magnitude now. Seems to me that I might have picked up an insight on that when Brother John Baker gave a talk at Jackson Convention a few years ago. And it just all made sense to me. So we got decades long here, decades long here, decades long here. And that finally leads us to Armageddon about a generation from now, which takes us right into the kingdom. So we're going to find this 40-year period. We're going to find a period of wind, including two world wars, all in the Acts picture, when we go to Acts chapter 27. That's why I just mentioned this here. Now, what I would like to do is use just the black, just the whiteboard if I can now. Just it's for the next part of it, it's going to be easier for me. So I'm going to turn this off.
Oh, we got a chain of us.
Okay. Now in Acts 27, we're going to have kind of a travel log of Paul's experiences. And let's see, I've got to draw a quick map of the middle. Oh, this isn't the right one. It's on the board. This has got to be a very, very bad map. This is freehand. But that's supposed to be Italy, in case it wasn't apparent, obviously. There's Turkey, there's Greece. And this is where Paul is going to start his journey. I'll put that in a different color. Paul has been captured at Jerusalem, but for his own safety, he was taken to the city of Caesarea on the coast. And that's where he spent a good 2 years in prison.
We have a map we could put underneath, and then you could just trace it. We have a map we can project, and then you could just mark on the map. It would be real accurate.
Okay. Let's see what the map is.
If you just put the map here, you can trace it right on there.
Okay.
And then we can you can still use your whiteboard.
Okay, all right. But you know what? I don't want to erase this now. I'm okay.
It's too good looking.
I wouldn't say that, but at least I hope you can recognize what it is. And if you can recognize it, then let's just go with this. And so we're going to start at Caesarea. Now, when we start in Acts chapter 27, it's not going to tell us that we're starting at Caesarea. You have to go back a chapter or two to see where you're starting from. But that's where we are. We're at Caesarea on the coast. Now, why is Caesarea called Caesarea? What's the point of that name? Because of Caesar. That's it. And so it's all about the Roman government. Now, when you start Acts 27, let's read verse 1, and we'll see a few other names that are involved with this as well. Estelle, would you read for us Acts 27, verse 1?
Do you have a microphone?
And when it was determined that we should sail into Italy, they delivered Paul and contained other prisoners unto one named Julius, a centurion of Augustus' band.
Okay. Now, starting at Caesarea, that reminds you of the Caesars. His captor's name is Julius. Kind of reminds you of Julius Caesar. And the band that he belonged to was the band of Augustus. Everything's Roman-oriented here. That's the point. And I think this is telling us that as the harvest begins, we, the Paul class, I think Paul represents the Lord's people during this whole experience. And we're going to see he's going to transition from the church to the great company to the ancient worthies as we go through our period today. And I think that Paul starts off picturing the church who is subject to the powers that be. Now, I'm just going to turn that off.
Is that okay?
Yeah.
Just hit the button.
Yeah.
And it'll go off. Oh, twice. Okay. I might turn it on a little later, but it's actually a distraction for me mentally, and I might get back to that, though. So I think it's showing at the beginning of the harvest that we are really subject to the powers that be. and we have to abide by the arrangements of this old world. And Paul, being a prisoner of the Roman Empire, is basically showing this concept that we are still subject to the powers that be. We'll be in charge later, but we're not yet. It's going to be a while yet. And in verse 2, when they enter into a ship of Adriamitium, and we'll see that on the map a little later, we launched, meaning to sail by the coast of Asia. Now, when the Bible talks about Asia, it's talking, as we know, not about over here where China and Korea and all that is. It's talking about this, what we would call Asia Minor. But may I say that I didn't know this for a long time, but I think it's proper to say now that Asia, as used in the scriptures, is even less than this. Asia is really this. It's really the southwest corner of what we would call today Asia Minor. Now, do you remember in Revelation it says the seven churches of, where are they? Of Asia. It doesn't say minor, but that's what it means. But they're not over here, or over here, or over here. It's not Galatia. They're all clustered right here. And you remember later on in, is it 2 Timothy, where Paul's writing his last letter to Timothy. And he says, you know, I've sent this brother over here, this brother over here. Demas, so he forsook me. And Luke, he's the only one with me. And he says, by the way, all they of Asia have turned away from me. He doesn't mean everybody here. He means everybody here. And where Paul ministered in his third missionary tour for 3 years was at Ephesus, the heart of this area. And they wept for him when he left. The elders of Ephesus, he called to Melita to see them one last time as he left. And they're tearful. And now, by the end of his life, they've all turned away from him. I find that very interesting. Sad. But the very people he spent so many years with, they were still Christian. He was still writing to Timothy. He told Timothy, stay at Ephesus, deal with this. But he wasn't really warmly received by these brethren anymore. I think there's a picture there too. We'll get to that when we get tomorrow on the three missionary tours. But this is Asia, and they wanted to go by the coast of Asia this way, onward to their travel to Rome. So they launch out. And the first port of call is up at Sidon. Now let's see that at verse 3. Adina, could you read that for us? Or are you operating with the Romanian Bible?
I got both.
Okay. Verse 3.
The next day, we put in a Sidon. The Jewish students called the consideration and allowed to go to the front of the Jewish care.
Okay, now here's Sidon up here. And it just took them a day to get there, basically. It was smooth sailing. No real problems. Just right on up the coast. Now, how were the headwinds on this trip? No mention of any problems whatsoever. Smooth sailing. They went up to Sidon, and there they docked. And Paul had a privilege here that was seems to me remarkable. Remember, he's a prisoner of the Roman Empire. Julius is his captor. He's a centurion. He's got a band and all that. And what does this Julius let Paul do when they get to Sidon?
Get off the ship?
Go visit the brethren and have some fellowship.
Oh.
This Paul must have been a remarkable personality that even his captor could appreciate his integrity. I mean, if Paul says, oh, this is my chance, I'm going to... No, he wouldn't do that, and Julius apparently saw that he wouldn't do that. He's putting his life on the line to be so helpful. I just can't imagine that most people that were subjects of prisoners of the Roman Empire were allowed this kind of privilege and liberty. It's just remarkable. Sidon is a sister city to Tyre. Tyre, in Ezekiel 28, is the great system that Satan has fostered. The king of Tyre is Satan there. What does Tyre represent as the great system that's been fostered by Satan? What do we often say?
Babylon.
Babylon. And you go to Revelation, it will quote from the prophecy about Tyre and applies it all to Babylon. I think that's great papism. You know, they didn't come to Tyre. They came to the sister city of Tyre. Sidon. Sidon and Tyre. It's like a couple of twins, you know, twin cities. Sidon, I would suggest, represents Protestantism. The sister city of Catholic. And that's where the truth movement really sprang out of. Now, you go back to the days of Martin Luther and the Reformation, it came out of the Catholic Church. But now, in the hundreds of years that have gone by since then, the truth movement really came out of mostly the Protestant systems. Not entirely. I mean, it's rather from wherever, you know, even the field, the world. And my brother's wife was a Catholic. One of the elders in San Diego, Brother Keith Kleppen, came right out of the Catholic Church. He brought his Douay Bible, you know, for a long time. He always enjoyed his version of things. But mostly it came out of the Protestant world. And I think that's what Docking at Sidon represents. And I will suggest that this represents the first 40 years of the harvest work. Great spiritual refreshment and pleasant fellowship among brethren of kindred minds. And now, let's see, this is...
you want to put it back on?
Oh, just now and then I might just... It just come on this time. Yeah, that's right. But the 40 years that... The 40 days that Elijah traveled in the strength of that second feeding, I think represent those 40 years from 1874 to 1914, before the time of trouble would break out. And the trouble had to wait until the truth movement had a chance to be distributed not only in America, but in England and in France and in Germany and throughout the Christian world. Now, it didn't go deeply into Africa and into India and other places. Not deeply. It touched there. And it's expanded there after the time of trouble has opened up. But the first... Let's see, where did we have this 40... Oh, yeah. This 40 years of the truth movement, 1874 to 1914, well, I think that's represented by this first period of pleasant refreshment and fellowship at Sidon. And now they're ready to launch out. And now when they launch out, they're going to get into some headwinds and some difficulty. So let's read now, starting at verse 4. But they go ahead.
Any significance to the next day thing? You know, I know it was smooth sailing, but one day is
right. It was very quick. I think the real key here is their period at Sidon, representing the 40 years of fellowship. And it was just very easy to get there and very smooth sailing, as it were. There may be something deeper, Dave, that I just don't know. Do you have an opinion?
Though, because, you know, if it started at Caesarea, maybe Caesarea represents something just slightly before that. I don't know.
It could. There is, when you go back in the previous chapters, which we'll get to maybe tomorrow, there is kind of a predicate for this whole harvest movement. But we'll talk about that tomorrow. But the very fact that it mentions one day in particular, I don't connect that to something. But maybe it's just because I don't see the depth. Yeah.
Are you saying the 40 days or 40 years? Is it the trip or is it their time?
Yeah, that's why it changes from here to there. I think it's really the time at Sidon. Because I think that represents the fellowship of the early truth movement, which is the first 40 years. Yes.
Wasn't there about 40 years before the 40 year process from the cleansing of the sanctuary?
About 31 years. 1843
to 1874. But if you count back to
1829. No, then you got...
Not exactly, but...
More than 40, yeah.
It was about that time that a lot of the Christians decided to throw everything out that they believed and study the Bible for themselves. They came to the conclusion there was no hell, no mortal soul, no Trinity, and some of them were already coming to the conclusion that there was two salvations.
Yes, all of that was a predicate. You know, even Brother Russell says, I didn't invent all this stuff. I just took the threads people had come up with and, you know, I was privileged to put it together in a package and distribute it. But you remember, this whole concept of 40 is coming from the Elijah experience, which came after the second feeding of Elijah. So that second feeding, I think, is the truth movement itself. And they went, that truth movement asked it for 40 years. So I think it takes you from 1874 to 1914. Now, you know, sometimes brother talk about a 40-year harvest. Well, I don't think that's quite the right perspective. But I do agree with the concept that there was a 40-year period. That's not defined as a harvest, but that was 40 years before the judgment began in World War I. So I think there's truth to that perspective. But there's much more to go on in the church's experience before the church is complete. Cheryl, do you have a thought?
I was thinking that even in a sense, there weren't any ecclesias in 1874. That didn't start until, really, I think it was about, was it in 1878 or 1881? Is that the time?
Jeff, what do you have?
I think there were a few ecclesias that were associated with this. It's sort of associated with Second Avenue. In the Pittsburgh area alone, there's one in Elgin. In 1874. George Storrs goes to visit them in 1874. And he writes glowing, reviews about Joseph L. Russell and the brethren that he met. What about Brothers?
Oh, interesting.
And then George Stetson, of course, and Jonas Wendell would go there often as well. And would kind of be the, elders of the church in that area.
Okay, well, thank you for that background. I know that Brother Russell was kind of a leader of a little Bible study group as early as 1870. When he was 18, he was elected. Well, that would take you to 1870?
Sure, because when I look at the Bible examiners at the time, the World's Crisis magazine, you can see George Stetson, Jonas Wendell, and George Storrs, and what they write about the congregations in Allegheny, Pittsburgh area, and they basically said that they're like a sheep without a shepherd. They didn't have a leader. And that's why they were going there, traveling often, and staying for months on end to try and, you know, prepare some ground for that church to actually grow. It wasn't until about 1876 or so that you actually see Brother Russell, at least in written documentation, actually step up to the plate and start to move forward.
Okay.
Which is why I think he wasn't mentioned in 1874 when George Storrs visited that area.
Okay, well, thank you. Okay, so now we're going to go on David, go ahead.
Well, just one other little point, you know, Sidon is just north of Tyre, they're sister cities, you're right, and normally, you know, if you were sailing, you'd come to Tyre first. It's just a little bit south, but I don't know if there's any significance to passing by. You know, they had the opportunity was there. They probably saw it as they went by, but they stopped at Sidon.
Okay, interesting. It's not like they couldn't make it there if they passed by, and the choice was Sidon. Okay, very good. So let's go to the next part now. This starts in verse 5. And let's see, Adina, were you ready to read that? I forgot, or did you read the previous verse? But anyway, go ahead and read verse 5. Oh, no, verse 4. I guess we need, what?
I have the quotation I can read if anyone would like me to read it.
On what?
On the Pittsburgh area being like a sheep without a shepherd.
Sure, go ahead.
This is from the World's Crisis, 1871.
Okay.
Jonas Wendell's writing. And this was after Brother Russell met him, which would have been about 1868, 69, when he rekindled his faith in the Bible, when he stumbled into that dark, dirty, dingy hall where he heard Jonas preaching. And they basically said, Sunday, November 5th, we met with the church in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and remained with them for about 4 weeks. We had meetings three times during the week and three times on Sunday. After I had been there 2 weeks, Brother G.W. Stetson of Ohio came to my help and is to remain until the 17th, I don't know what INST means, at which time, if the Lord will, I am to return and to remain with them for a season. The meetings thus far have resulted in great good. The church in Pittsburgh have been like a sheep without a shepherd. And then he goes on to explain how they're just trying to prepare that church to stand on their own.
Okay, very interesting. Okay, Sister Dina, let's go on now to verse 4.
From there we put out to sea and sailed under the shelter of Cyprus because the winds were contrary.
So they meet some winds. As soon as they lunch out, they hit some winds. Now here's Cyprus here, and it says under the protection of Cyprus. What is it? How does it express it?
Some translations say under the lee.
Under the lee. Okay. Now, I would say if it's under, it's going this way. But that's not the point. Because it actually, the winds are out here, and under the protection, I think, means here. And they're hugging the coastline. That's the situation. So they're coming this way. And it says that the winds are against them. Now, over here in the Elijah picture, the winds represent war, as they do elsewhere in Scripture. So I think this is suggesting that after they leave here, the first 40 years of the harvest, they hit the winds of war in World War I. And now it's not fair sailing anymore. Now they've got to be careful about their circumstance. Now, in verse 5, Adina, could you read that as well?
When we had sailed through the sea along the coast of Sicilia and Pamphylia, we landed at Mura in Lycia.
Okay, so they passed through two areas, two regions. Cilicia, the Sea of Cilicia, and the Sea of Pamphylia. I just suggest that this is telling us that there are two periods where they're struggling against these winds. And I think that's World War I and World War II. So it's telling us not only that there's a wind phase, but that there's two parts to this wind phase. And all of that is, I think, in this second part of their journey. And finally they land here at the city of Myra in the area of Lycia. That's where they're going to dock, and they're going to change ship. Now, Bill, you had a comment or a question?
Well, you know, I'm getting back to Brother Dave's question on the day there in verse 3. The next day we put out in at Sidon. I'm wondering, you know, you're saying from C to S is from 1799 to 1874.
I'm not really meaning that. They were at Caesarea. Just showing that he... maybe it's true.
Okay, well, this is just let me make my comment, and then we can investigate it or whatever. That day there, you know, in Matthew, the parable of the penny, you know, that's a day, that's the harvest period, that's the full harvest. After that, I don't see where we talk about days anymore. You know, I don't know how many days transpired, so maybe that's the whole from us all the way to wherever we'll keep on going. Just a thought here, that includes that it's the harvest.
So how are you integrating that day? I'm not getting your thought. You say the
parable of cunning. There's a day.
Yes, I understand. But here, when it says the next day, what are you saying that refers to?
It's just pointing out that it's a day, and it starts that day, the harvest day.
So this beginning of this fellowship at Sidon would be the
beginning of the harvest. The
beginning of the harvest. And the parable of the penny, and that day is the harvest period.
Just throwing that out there, I don't know.
It's the only time we see a record of a specific time, isn't it?
Yeah.
Specific day.
I mean, it's interesting.
Yeah, that's interesting.
And it's one day.
Yeah.
The only other thing I can tie it into is, you know, the Matthew scripture.
Okay.
Parable of the penny.
Now, when they get to Myra, they change ship. Now, let's see that in verse 6. Sister Carol, could you read that for us?
Let's get the mic.
And there the centurions found a ship of Alexandria sailing into Italy, and he put us therein.
Okay. Now, they're ultimately going to go over here and reach Rome. I mean, that's the goal. And so they found a ship of Alexandria, does it say? That's sailing from here onward to here. Now, for some reason, that ship of Alexandria down here had made port of call up here. Now, what's on the ship from Alexandria is a boatload of grain. We're going to see that later in the narrative. Well, that's because they had grain down here, and that fed a lot of the Roman world. So I don't know, maybe they needed some grain up here and that's why it stopped. But for whatever reason, that grain is ultimately going to end up, well, the theory was, that grain is going to be on its way to Rome. And that's why the ship is headed to Rome. But the point I want to make here is that it's a different ship. When they get to Myra, they change ship. And I think that's telling you something about the ship of state that the brethren are on traveling through the harvest. It's not always the same ship. The ship of state changes. And I think it changed after the wind phase, after they went through the Sea of
Cilicia and the Sea of Pamphylia, two stages of war, the political structure of Christendom, of the Western world, is no longer the same. Now, primarily, I think, this is a European picture, that's where old Christendom is. I don't think things changed radically in America, although you could say, yeah, they did with the New Deal and political things changed quite, oh, okay, maybe. But you have a different political structure now when the kings of Europe are gone and the circumstances change. The politics change, the countries change. So I think that ship of state that's going to go to ruin now is not the old one. We've changed from that after World War II. Now, I'll just expand on this a little bit to give you a thought that, well, let's see what you think about it. You know, but you know, back in Daniel, the second chapter, with that image of Gentile power, Babylon, Persia, Greece, and then Rome. And then the rock strikes that image, and it breaks apart. Now, most of the brethren, not all, but most of the brethren say that rock struck the image in 1914. I personally think that's correct. I think that's the wind phase that's hitting that structure that has grown up in Christendom, and it begins to impact it and break it down. Now, the thought that I'd like to suggest there, that may be just a little new, is there's some seasonal mention here. See, this is Daniel 2. Verse 34 and 35. Let's read verse 35 in particular. Carol, could you read that for us too? Daniel 2:35. If you don't have it there quite, maybe Randy, are you there? Daniel 2:35. Well, Carol, maybe you've got it by now.
Daniel
2:35.
And was the iron, the clay, the brass, the silver, and the gold broken to pieces together and became like the chaff of the summer threshing floors?
Okay.
And
oh, yeah, sorry, go ahead.
And the wind carried them away, that no place was found for them. And the stone that smote the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth.
Okay. Now, that talks about a season of the year. What season is it when this is all transpiring? Or what's this linked in here? Summer. Summertime. So in the scriptures, you only have two seasons, and not like the four seasons that we have today. You have summer and winter. Now, you remember in Matthew 24, he says, pray that your flight not be in the winter. In Song of Solomon, when the harvest comes, it's a time of singing of birds, and it's time when the fig tree puts forth its leaves. Spring, summer, that's the one season. That's the summertime of the harvest. We're in the harvest here. The stone strikes the image not in the winter time of trouble, but in the summertime. I think that tells us that it's 1914, not in the future in Armageddon. But the point that was of interest to me here is that the winds carried them away and it became as the chaff of the summer threshing floor. It doesn't say the winter winds finally come and sweep them away. The winter winds might be like Armageddon, you know, way down at the bottom here. Armageddon. But it doesn't say that. It says the winds of summer. And I'm wondering if really that image was broken through World War I and World War II. And the winds that carried them away were the two world wars that broke and crushed and swept them away. And that in after World War II, we basically have a new ship of state. We don't have the old anymore. Now, let me flesh that out a little bit more. You know, before the four world empires came into vogue, before Babylon came as the empire, was there any empires before that? In the Middle East, where Israel was, were there any empires before that?
Ottoman.
No. Before Babylon.
Well, before Babylon.
There was Egypt.
Syria.
And there was Assyria.
Right.
They were very strong empires. They weren't counted in the image because neither of them broke the independence of God's people and the throne of Israel. Now, they did take away the 10 tribes in the north. Assyria took them away. And then Assyria came into the south. And the prophecy of Isaiah said it would be like a flood that would come up to the neck. But it didn't go over the head. And so Hezekiah was saved. The throne was spared. And they never went into captivity to Assyria. So the vision of four world empires that govern God's people don't start with Assyria. It starts with Babylon that did take Judah and took Zedekiah off the throne. And the throne of the Lord was therefore overturned and overturned and overturned until finally Jesus came and he got the right for that. But my point is that there were strong governments and empires before the image. And I would just suggest that the fact that America is still here and the Soviet Union was here after World War II and other strong countries, that doesn't tell us that the image hasn't been smitten and hasn't been swept away. I rather think it has been. And in fact, when you get into Zechariah, you find out even when the kingdom is established, he will rebuke strong nations afar off, and if they don't come up to worship the Lord at Jerusalem, there'll be no rain of blessing. And if that doesn't work, there'll be the plague on them. There's going to be strong people still into the kingdom. So if we're waiting for the time when all governments are wiped out before the image is gone, we'll be waiting until well into the kingdom. And I wonder if maybe this is really telling us that in 1945, at the end of World War II, the old image of church, state, Christendom has now been effectively removed. And now, if that's true, then we begin to see the growth of the kingdom. Well, we don't see the kingdom yet, do we? Well, not yet, not thoroughly. We see the king, you know, and the saints beyond. But we do see a growth that's going to be the kingdom. And that's the nation of Israel. When did they get independence? Randy, you said 1948? 48? 47 in India. Okay, 47 in India. So, but with Israel, that's going to be the kingdom. It began to grow in 1948. And it's going to expand and finally become the kingdom to govern the whole world. And, you know, back in the flood episode, some of you heard some thoughts on that before. They look out, and the first thing they see that suggests that this curse is ending is that the top of the mountains out there, I think that's a picture of Israel. That's the sign that the kingdom is going to progress. Now, Israel is not yet converted. They're still in unbelief. Many of them believe in God, but as a nation, they're not really a nation of faith yet. But they're expanding, and it's God's hand on them. And I wonder if maybe this stone is already growing. We see the effect of it. It's just not become established as the kingdom of Christ under Christ yet. Well, just a thought. That would at least synchronize the fact that the summer threshing floor, and the summer is still, the harvest still in World War II, and the fact that they changed the ship of state here. The new ship of state is going to go to ruin still, but the old is really gone. Randy, I've deferred your comments so long. Thank you.
For sure. Tells us, we need the microphone. Tells us that connection, quote, the connection between the Jews and Cilicia, just what you mentioned, dates from the time when it became part of the Syrian kingdom.
Oh, okay, way back. Okay, okay.
Designates the north, the west, and the east from that point. It's really rather interesting.
Okay, now I didn't know that, Randy. I'm glad you mentioned that. But I think when they say the Syrian kingdom, they're not going back to Assyria before Babylon, but to the Seleucid kingdom that was a fragment of the Grecian Empire. But I didn't realize. I guess it took all this in, and that's where the Jewish presence began to go there. Okay, thank you. That's a very interesting point.
Paul was in his hometown. He mentions there that he was in his hometown.
In Tarsus up here.
Right.
Which is part of Cilicia.
Yeah, and yeah. That's probably why the centurion let him go, because he said, well, let him visit a bit.
Okay, all right.
I'm just wondering if we can put some dates on some of these points. I mean,
oh, yeah,
we can erase them and change them, you know, as we go through, but it would be nice to put some mile markers on there.
Yeah, that's a good idea. I'm going to put 1945 here, and I'll put 18, let's see, I'll put when they left here. Let's put it when they left here. I think we're up to 1914. The beginning of the harvest were in 1874. and I'll put a few more dates as we go. And that's a good idea for the book. Yes.
I've been compelled to say for years now that after 45, we actually see a new administration in the American, and of course, General Eisenhower is soon to become President Eisenhower. And what you find is an amazing collection of fulfillments of prophecy, almost a mini kingdom, if it were ever to last, because you have Israel consoled and also becoming a nation, but you also see the papacy redressed and embarrassed in the extreme because of its alliance with Japan. And what business does it have with Japan, a pagan country largely with pagan gods and so on? But anyway, it just seems that everything has declined in terms of fulfillment of Bible prophecy since then. There's a tendency to want to tear that down.
Okay, thank you, Brother Andy. Okay, now, everything we've read here, we're up to, what, verse 6 or so? It's happening pretty quick. We're skipping quickly through the harvest, and we got most of the chapter to go. That's because most of this chapter deals with the events toward the end of the harvest, where we're involved. But Dave?
Yeah, just a point here. You know, we have three things: World War One, then the Depression, then World War Two. And you know, you see, it really mentions three things in verses 5 and 6. It mentions, you know, passing by or passing under Cyprus, and then it mentions the two other places,
Cilicia and Pamphylia.
Is there any significance where the Depression is maybe shown as one of them?
That's a good question, Brother Dave. I just don't know. That's why when you look at the experience of Elijah, you don't see the same detail as when you look in the seven plagues of Revelation. You just see the wind phase, period. The wind phase, however, is in two parts, and when you get down to Revelation, it shows a third part even in between the two. Whether those three mentioned Cyprus, Cilicia, that's very intriguing, Dave. That's hadn't occurred to me. That's a nice thought. I just don't know. That's a reasonable kind of investigation. That's great. That's better. Thank you. That somehow my mind is more at ease. I'm like a piece of the wall. Then too, everything was kind of strange the other way. But that one unified period of wind seems to be that trip from here to there, and they hit the headwinds. But it had two seas that they passed through as those two events of this wind. Jerry, did you have a comment?
I was just feeling myself
a little warm. Huh? A little warm. Dave.
Yeah. Gabriel just mentioned something to me. You know, when you leave Sidon there, they picked up some wind.
Yeah.
And then they mentioned Cyprus as maybe a little bit of protection from that wind, and then they sailed on. So perhaps there's that little bit of protection. That was a little bit of when the winds
between the two wars.
Between the two wars, it's really one big war, but it's yeah, with a little break in between. Maybe that's the break in the wind. There.
Okay, very interesting. Now that's the kind of detail that is good to explore. Very, very good.
Just one other thing, you know, I think it's interesting that the
ship of state there, the new ship of state is a grain ship. And we do know that we suspect it's a grain ship coming from Egypt.
It is, because we're going to see there's grain mentioned later. Go ahead.
Okay. You know, that generally speaking, I know it's perhaps not worldwide, but generally speaking, there was great economic prosperity just after World War II, and so the grain could picture prosperity, perhaps?
Okay, interesting. There was a pickup, wasn't there, everywhere in the Western world. Okay, now let's go on to the next step from here and see what the narrative suggests happens after this. This is now in verse
7, verse 7.
Sister Winnie, could you read that for us?
We made slow headway for many days and had difficulty arriving off Sidus. When the wind did not allow us to hold our course, we sailed to the lee of Crete, opposite Salamone.
Okay, that's one verse that takes a lot of scope of time here. But Cnidus, as you mentioned, it actually exists today. It's really called Cnidos. Now, if you say that I like an E, and emphasize the N and not the C, then you could have that as Cnidos or Cnidos. And that's a place on the mainland here that juts out like a peninsula. So it's really part of land, but it sticks out of the sea. It's the last port of call when you're leaving the mainland. And it says they sailed slowly many days. Now I'm going to put a date on that of 1989, because I think that slow sailing for many days takes you to the next stage. Now, here we've got the 40 years of Elijah's the 40 days of Elijah to Mount Horeb. Here we've got those 40 years. They launch out, and that takes us through the two periods of war to 1945. The next thing involved is the earthquake. And that earthquake is the breakup of the colonial powers that started after World War II and takes us through, as Bill said, I think, to the breakup of the last major colonial empire. And that was Russia, the Soviet Union. And while technically it was 1991, in 1989 is where everybody marks the real breakup. That was when finally Romania got independence in 1989. That was, you know, they say Poland, it took 10 years, Czechoslovakia 10 months, and Romania 10 days, something like that. That was the progression, started snowballing. And by the time Romania broke away, I think that was everybody's all, that's basically the end, you know, got a few formalities to go through. But 1989 was the catalytic year, where everything broke apart. That's why I'll put that date here. And it says slowly many days. Well, that's like 54 years there. That was, I don't know, 44 years. That's quite a period of time. So from 1945 to 1914, we had not that long. But this is the longer period of time, and it covers it very briefly, because it's going to head on to the end of the harvest more than the beginning. But I think that's that earthquake phase. And now you're leaving every vestige of the mainland. This is the old order. And you're leaving every vestige of it. You're launching out into the new circumstance. Yeah, that's a new ship of state here. But they're still on the old mainland. You've still got the old Cold War dealing with the residue of World War I and World War II. But not until 1989 do you launch out into a new world order. And that's what Gorbachev and... So Gorbachev and Bush won by that time. Coined this phrase, the New World Order. And I think they're right. This was a new structure, a new situation. And I think that takes you to the end of the Soviet Empire, basically, in 1989. And now we're ready to launch into a new phase. Now, if I didn't...
Did you mean a New World Disorder?
Yeah, the New World Disorder. Yeah, that's right. Now, if we didn't see that here in Elijah, we have these discrete periods of 40, then the wind, then the earthquake, and then the Islamic insurgency, then we might not be able to identify it here or feel pretty weak about it. But it's matching the same division that we see in the Elijah picture. And I think these ports of call are really the same things that we're seeing in the two pictures that give us a little strength that we're on the right road. So that's all in just half a verse, the first half of verse 7. And then it says they had to go down and sail under Crete. Now, normally you could have gone from here around Greece, which I've probably shown too deep. It's not as big of an impediment as appears on my map, and gone here up to here, you know, to Rome. And I remember thinking in 1989 when the Soviet Union broke apart, which surprised me. It didn't surprise everybody apparently, but I think it surprised most brethren. Thinking prophetically, I thought Soviet Union would be intact when they came down as Gog against Israel. I still think it's Russia. Had to double think that. Is that right or wrong? I don't know. We've got to evaluate as we go. I still think it's Russia, but it's not the Soviet Union. It's different than we expected. But I remember thinking, well, what remains to intervene before we sail right on to the kingdom? Well, I guess quite a bit. We just didn't know what was going to happen next. Now we look back, it's been a couple of decades, and now we have a little bit of perspective on it. But in fact, there were more experiences to undergo. And so they didn't head right off to Rome. They got diverted. They had more winds, more trouble, more difficulty that caused them to divert down to Crete. Crete's down here, and this whole thing is, like I say, not quite in perspective, but give you a rough idea. So they head down here, which is too sharp an angle, really. Head down here, and they barely pass a place called Salmone, which is on the edge of Crete. Salmone means billows. That's a natural name for a spot like that, because that's where the sea billows are going to roll in. And it says they barely got by there. So things were pretty rough. It wasn't easy going. So now since 1989, we might have thought everything would be smooth sailing onto the kingdom. Turns out, hasn't been so. Just a couple of years later, I still remember I was in an airport coming home from some convention somewhere, and at the CNN monitors, I hear this, Iraq has invaded Kuwait. And I still remember my surprise, thinking, oh, what's this all about? Is this a blip on the radar? This is meaningless, just a little problem? Or is this a new big problem? It turned out to be the latter, in my opinion. It turned out to be the beginning of the whole Arab problem, Islamic problem. Now, we went through Iraq 1. It was a very quick victory. And now we pulled out, and then now we're back in Iraq 2. Seemed like a quick victory, but now we're still there. And then the Afghanistan problem, the 9/11, and boy, the whole... Now we're just in a quagmire.
Pakistan.
The whole, it's a nightmare. And here we are in this Islamic insurgency, and we're going to barely pass Salmone. Brother Jeff, what did you have to contribute here?
I just had a comment about Russia.
Is there a microphone there?
I'm going to read just a couple paragraphs from a book called Epicenter.
Okay.
The Russians in 1994, one of their leaders of the political party, I forget his name, it's one of those names you can't pronounce, Vladimir Volfovich Sharinovsky, something like that. They've written a manifesto explaining why they want Russia to expand. It says, the operation should be carried out using the code name Final Thrust to the South. Our army will carry out this task. It will be a means for the nation as a whole to survive and a way to restore the Russian army. Russia reaching to the shores of the Indian Ocean and the Mediterranean Sea. They want control of the ports. So they still want Israel. And there's a lot of documentation on this in this book.
That's very interesting, Jeff. I'm glad you brought that up. I remember a reading in the book The Guns of August about the World War I. How before World War I, famous general in Germany says, I got the plans all figured out. Next time we have a problem, this is what you do. This is how you attack France. This is, and you know, when World War II came, no, that was World War I. When World War I launched, they put that whole plan into effect. But that plan had come from years earlier, after in the aftermath of the Franco-Prussian War. Well, now, the point is that their plans and schemes were there, and finally, years later, it came to fruition. So now we see the Russian plans, their thinking, it's already forming in this direction. I didn't actually realize that. That's intriguing to me. Yes, Brother Andy.
As a comment to a Canadian documentary specialist by the name of Michael McClure, in the early 80s, put out something called the truth about Vietnam, and really what he did end up saying was that the Western nations for some reason wanted to end Russia. It was their goal, even though no one guessed it early on, but the final result seems to be clear that they wanted to break Russia financially, and the only way they could was by making sure that the Ho Chi Minh Trail literally was filled with arms to go to the south into Vietnam to fight this war. And if you wonder about the mystery about the seesaw battle, taking of a territory and the losing of it almost deliberately, and then taking it again at the great loss of life, he gives the impression that it was none for no other reason than to break Russia financially by producing 24 hours, 7 days a week, 365 days, constantly not only impoverishing Russia, but also to pollute the land too, and make a victory to show that Russia could not last, should not last, would not last. And it wasn't long after Vietnam that this is really what happened. He makes a pretty good thing. I just offer that as an explanation as to the fact that the Western countries certainly had a view to stop Russia and to completely break its back.
Okay, well, interesting perspective. Okay, now we've barely made it past Salmone, and finally they come to a port called, appropriately, if you're writing this as a novel, you couldn't think of a better word for it, Fairhaven. They come to that on the underbelly of Crete, and that's where they find some safety. Now, where are we today on this whole thing? Well, I think we're not there at Fairhaven yet. Maybe we are. But I think when it says they fairly passed Salmone, this period of billows, that maybe this is telling us that we're passing through these economic billows and we're not through it yet. I don't think we've really recovered from the real estate bust. And I don't know whether we got another billow or two coming up. I rather suspect we might. We'll see. We need some perspective. We'll have to wait a few years and see how things develop. But I would say we're somewhere around here. We're not yet passed through those billows, and we haven't yet reached Fairhaven. And I think we have more economic problems to come. I think it's going to shake things. But I think we're going to then stabilize, because, you know, we got some time before the kingdom. It's not on the cusp yet, but it's coming pretty close. So I think we're in this area somewhere. We're still passing through these billows before we reach Fairhaven. That's my opinion. Now, this makes it is meaningful where we are, because in the next couple of verses we're going to see some keys that might tell us something about the high calling. Verse 8. Did we read verse 8?
No.
Not yet. Okay. Brother Randy, would you read that for us?
And hardly passing it, came unto a place which is called the Fair Havens, nigh whereunto was the city of Lycia.
Okay, so that's where they dock, and they stay there for a little bit. And now it says in verse 9, now when much time was spent, and sailing was now dangerous, because the fast was past. Well, what does a fast have to do with being dangerous sailing? Paul admonished them and says, don't try this. Now, what is that fast talking about? And what would that have to do with sailing, dangerously or otherwise?
The time of the year that we're talking about. Talking right. About September, when things start getting a little bit...
Okay. Remember, there's only two seasons, as the Bible is concerned, but not the four we have today. Winter's coming up. And you're going to have rough seas out there, and it's no longer safe. Now, Paul had some experience here. He wasn't a shipmaster, but he had traveled quite a bit. You know, later and to the Corinthians, not later, but earlier, before all this, he wrote to the Corinthians and says, I went through all these problems 3 times, shipwrecked, a day and a night spent on the heart of the sea. He's going to be shipwrecked another time. Those 3 times doesn't even include the one coming up. So he's gone through shipwrecks 3 times. He's a little sensitive about what's dangerous and what's not dangerous. He's got a little bit of information on this subject. And he says, it's danger coming up. Brother Jeff?
What is the fast again?
What is the fast? Now, you've got the right time of year. What is the fast talking about?
I think it's talking about
the booths, the festival of the booths.
But did you fast at the festival of booths?
The Day of Atonement.
It's right at the right time. Because the Day of Atonement was on the 10th day of the month, then the Feast of Booths was on the 15th. So I think we're just past that fast. And you're right, it's right in September-October region. I think you're right. So the fast of the Day of Atonement. Now, I think that's the right answer, Jeff. And when I look at commentaries on this point, they all seem to agree. This is the Day of Atonement he's talking about. So if that's the point, I think there's a meaning here. Day of Atonement is the day when sacrifices were made. Now, in Tabernacle Shadows, there's a suggestion that that's Christ and then the church as well. Is this suggesting the time when the age for sacrifice is beginning to draw to a close? Now, I know there's been a concern for many years whether the high calling is closed or not. Well, not so much in our fellowship, but a difference like that is going to rend the fellowship. And that's why the laymans are over there and others are over here. But in Europe and Russia and Romania and Moldova, you have, you know, that same question among the brethren. And I don't think the high calling has closed, but it's going to start closing down before the kingdom comes. Let's say, whenever it comes, a year before the kingdom. You think the high calling is going to be roaring forth? It's got to have to start to close down at some point, because you need time to develop as a new creature. And it's not for us to shut the door until the end, perhaps, but I think this scripture is suggesting that when the fast is past, the age in which the high calling is open is going to start closing down even before Armageddon gets here. Now, I don't think that means the church is gone or the great company is gone, because they have been begotten, but I think the work of new inductees is closing down. So it says that when they came to Fairhaven, they spent a good deal of time there. That's when they said to themselves, we want to launch out again, because they know winter's approaching. The shipmaster knows that. He knows he's not going to make it to Rome. He's got that clear. But he wants to go on to this place. He says it's more commodious for us there. It's a place called Phoenix. Now here, it doesn't give it quite with that spelling, but I think that's the place. Now let's see. Well, let's read verse 9 and also verse 10. And this is what Paul's warning is. Now, Paul speaks for the first time here. Now, he went ashore and he had a lot of talk there, fellowship with the brethren. Since that time, in this narrative, we only see him talking here. And then he's going to talk twice more before we get to the shipwreck. And I think every time Paul speaks, it has something to say about the Lord's people and their position and their voice and their message. This is what Paul says. Sherelle, can you read that for us? Verse 9 and 10.
So that's Acts 27, 9 and 10?
Yes.
And when considerable time had passed and the voyage was now dangerous, since even the fast was already over, Paul began to admonish them and said to them, Men, I perceive that the voyage will certainly be attended with damage and great loss, not only of the cargo and the ship, but also of our lives.
And keep on a little bit.
But the centurion was more persuaded by the pilot and the captain of the ship than by what was being said by Paul.
Keep going.
And because the harbor was not suitable for wintering, the majority reached a decision to put out to sea from there, if somehow they could reach Phoenix, a harbor of Crete, facing southwest and northwest, and spend the winter there.
Okay, that's where they're headed, to this other port. Now, Phoenix, you know, that got its name because of this bird, the phoenix, you know. What was the story about the phoenix, the bird?
It revives from its ashes.
Came out of the ashes and rose again. Yeah, that's it. And I think this is telling us something about the circumstances of the Western world here. I think the problem is the economy. The other flip side of the coin is the Islamic insurgency. But in the West, we've got a problem with the drying up of the economy. Now, you go to plague number 6 in Revelation, before Armageddon. It's the drying up of the river Euphrates. And, of course, literally, that's what Cyrus did. He diverted the river Euphrates so he could get into Babylon and conquer the city. I think that's what Christ is doing. He's seeing the withering of the river Euphrates to weaken Babylon so that it can fall and crumble. Because as long as we've got financial dynamics going on, it seems pretty strong. But you wither the financial strength of the Western economies, and now we need help. We're in help. I mean, communism is not working. That's gone. And the last great bastion is capitalism. The whole world is looking to capitalism. And for 10 years, that did great in the 1990s. And now suddenly it began to turn. You say, well, we'll get through that. Yeah, we got through that stock market. Now we got the real estate. Now all the banks in the Western world, basically, not only in America, but in Europe, are at risk because of this, as they say, toxic assets that they've got. And we haven't worked our way through all that yet. And that's still a problem. Now, you know that there was a large number amount of money that the United States government has pumped into the banking system. What I didn't know until recently was that a good portion of that money went overseas to overseas banks because they are all interconnected and they've got to be propped up too. What a mess.
Yeah, we bailed out the Bank of England.
Well, you see, the whole thing is just kind of weak, and now we can prop it up for a while, but I don't think it's gonna not work in the big picture. And River Euphrates is drying up. Now, I remember years ago, Brother Randy, go ahead.
Around the time of the Day of the Atonement, it was common on our farm to know that you would not be able to take your potato crop off very easily if you were after what is called the Jewish holiday at that point. And it means a change in climate in the Middle East is what I think it is, where those winds, as you say, start to blow, and they are natural forces. It's an amazing thing, a natural force that would stop them from easily reaching Phoenix.
Interesting. So even in Canada, that was that marked a change of season.
Yeah, it got very wet, cold, and snow after that.
Very interesting. That's a common update to this very, very issue that's marked here after the fast. Change of circumstance. So, we're somewhere in here. We haven't reached that point, Fair Haven, yet, in my opinion, because we're not out of the woods yet. And I think when we do reach that point, it'll be a recovery from a debacle, but it won't be strong. It won't be the riches that we're accustomed to. It won't be the prosperity we have attracted to. And that's why the Western world. And that's why they say we got to launch out and we got to try something better. And Paul says, no, just appreciate what you've got. Don't take that next step. I'm telling you, I'm warning you against it. And I wonder if that's not the Micaiah picture back in 1 Kings 22. There's a coalition that is imagined between the false prophet, 400 false prophets, the two-horned leader, and Ahab, there's papacy. They want to get together and reestablish themselves. And Micaiah steps forward, he's brought forward, and said, what's your opinion? He says, you know, write it out. And, of course, the shipmaster is not going to pay attention to what the church says. So I don't think we're there yet. I don't think we're to that voice yet, that message. I don't think we're really even to Fair Haven yet. I think we've got some more billets to go through. I've got some time ahead of us. Now, we're going to backtrack a little bit when we get farther on into the storm here and see about some times. But if we, from 2000, roughly, when the stock market took a plunge, and I had some skin in the game, as they say, you know, and so I remember that.
You lose something, you remember it.
So that was 2000. I know that the NASDAQ market was up to like 5,000. Now, these days, it's about 2,500. You realize we're only halfway back to where we were? And now we got the real estate crisis. 8 years later, it came after that. So we have another billow 8 years more down the road, maybe another one. I don't know, 2016, I don't know. I've got a decade ahead of us, at least, before we are really past this part. We'll see. We're just estimating here.
Well, just a comment, too. I think it's interesting that the government talks about, they used to talk about 1 year, recovery next year. I mean, now they're talking about 2013, 2014. I mean, they're projecting because they don't see a quick recovery.
And now we have the sovereign debt crisis in Europe, and it's popping up. And they got that, so no, not quite. You got to stop on that. No, it's still bubbling up. And some people predict that sovereign debt crisis is headed our way, too. We'll see. You know, finances are above me. I don't know. I can balance my checkbook. That's about it. Because it's very small numbers, you know. So I don't know what's going to happen. We'll see when we get there, you know. These days. So we're on our way there. But I think that's where we are. And now we're going to be peering into what's coming ahead of us in the future and seeing what is before us before we sail on to the kingdom. That's in the next few verses. So, yes, Brother Randy.
Is partly a jest, but
the word Cyprus is another word for copper. So the copper mines are are strong on that island. So
okay, I didn't know that.
And so Paul was saying before they were rounding the coin, maybe it's symbolic, that don't invest in gold and silver or anything like that, but of course we should be, but invest in copper. You have to get to Phoenix type of thing. In other words,
That's interesting. It's another dimension. Another dimension. Okay, thank you. Okay, so they are going to ignore what Paul said, and they're going to launch out. Let's see what happens. Verse 13. Do you have an English Bible there? Esther, would you read verse 13?
Verse 13. When a light wind began blowing from the south, the sailors thought they could make it. So they pulled up anchor and sailed along close to shore.
Okay, so they're going to sail on here to Phoenicia and try their luck at that. Now we're going to see that south wind again. The south wind is this general wind that seems to be favoring them. We're going to see it at the end of their journey when they finally make their way up to Rome. We're going to see a south wind that does favor them and it'll bring them into the kingdom. But not yet. There's a south wind. Seems like everything's okay. But immediately they launch out and they run into trouble. Esther, would you read that next verse?
Okay. Verse 14. But the weather changed abruptly and the wind of typhoon strength, a northeaster, they called it, caught the ship and blew it out to sea.
Okay. Northeastern wind hit them. Now in the American, in the King James, it calls it Euroclydon. And it's related. May I just suggest, maybe this is too superficial, but I'm not sure that it is. I think it may be related. There's a whole other branch of prophecy we haven't talked about. And that's Revelation chapter 17. Chapter 17 of Revelation, I just mentioned it verbally here. It's all about 10 horns coming together for a brief period. And the 10 horns are not South America. It's not the Orient. It's Europe. This is European. Those are the 10 political powers of Europe. Now, I won't say they're 10 in number now, but historically they've been, you know, started out as 10 horns, and I think the 10 just tells you the political powers of Europe. Well, Europe is trying to get together. Now, from the days of Charlemagne, when things broke apart, they have never had a united kingdom. They're trying to put this all together and have a united kingdom. They've got a common currency. They targeted that for 1992, and they didn't get it by that time, but it did come later. Now they've got the euro. England is not part of this, but most mainland countries in Europe are part of it. They're not satisfied. They want a common constitution. And when that common constitution comes about, if it does, do you think it's going to be pro or negative to Israel? I would say not pro. I would say, you know, even our government, in my opinion, isn't as pro-Israel as they could be, but at least it's not as bad as it is across the seas in some of the normal Western countries, the bigger Western countries of Europe, where Israel is really not in good graces. And I think this is maybe telling us something about how Revelation 17 comes into the picture. They launch out, and there's this Euroclydon wind. Europe is called Europe because it means, was that east? Something like that. And there's Euroclydon, northeast wind. That's where your Bible said it. It's coming from the northeast. Remember, the south wind is the gentle wind. The northeast, coming from this direction, is not so gentle. And this northern wind that's going to blow down from Russia and Europe, I think, is maybe referred to here. This is going to be a problem that springs up from Europe, the European Union, when they come together more cohesively. That's very interpretive. Almost speculative, but I think Revelation 17 does tell us that the 10 countries of Europe are going to come together. When they do, it's not going to be beneficial to papacy either. Maybe papacy thinks so, but what it says is that they're going to eat her flesh and burn her with fire. I think this is the destruction of papacy, not the rise of papacy. But that's the Armageddon picture, you see. It's coming. But the Euroclydon is trouble coming from Europe. And I think Revelation 17 tells us there's something building there that's not going to be helpful. Brother Randy.
Just mentioned too that when the truth first came out, you could not ignore the emphasis on Israel. And literally, God's turning his attention once more to 2,000 and 3,000-year-old promises that you only have I known of all the nations of the earth. Saying in effect that Israel is like his wife. He's betrothed to her. And so on. And although the truth comes in with a dimension and a huge, massive information from the scripture, that there is a challenge to in any of Europe's, or as we say, Catholic view, that they are the darling of God. And so you have a elegant and very, very powerful drama taking place.
Okay. So they launch out and they get caught up in this wind, and it's just tempestuous, and they lose control. Now, we're not there yet, but I think that is plague number 6. When things get so difficult in the Western world, things begin to unravel somewhat. I don't think that's quite to Armageddon yet. Not yet. We get to the crash landing when the ship of state breaks apart. That's Armageddon. Cheryl?
I don't have a map of the world in front of me, but I'm just trying to figure out, because it seems to me that northeast of that area is not Europe, which is northwest, but it's Russia and China, which is potentially in Scripture also.
Just where the geographies lie, that's a good question. Now, if you're down here, Europe is in the north here. And,
is it east or is it west?
And east would be Russia. Now, this gets to another area of prophecy, Ezekiel 38, 39 rather. And it's your Uncle Jim said something years ago. Now, I hope I'm not misrepresenting him. But he talked about the first ally of Gog is Gomer, the strongest ally of Gog. And the question is, who's Gomer? He said Gomer was that people north of the Black Sea that migrated northward into Germany. I even wonder if that word Gomer and Germany are, you know, linguistically related somehow. What has populated all of Europe? Even France. They're Germanic tribes. I'm talking about Western Europe now. They're Germanic tribes. Now, certainly not Romania, because that's coming from the stock down a little bit different. What's that? That's different. That's why I'm talking about Western as opposed to Eastern.
And Charlemagne was considered by many.
Yeah, he was. Yeah, he basically was. And so even France and Germany had this hostility all these years. They're both basically Germanic. They're Germanic tribes, even, even the Italians. And Romania has the influence from there. It's all Germanic tribes, the Huns, the Lombards, the Ostrogoths, and all this stuff. So they fanned out over Europe, and maybe, therefore, Gomer is talking about Europe. Now, you know, in the first Gulf War, everybody was pretty much united against Iraq. Second Gulf War, didn't work that way. It was America and England on one side, and France, Germany, and Russia were not all that pleased with what America did. Now, and so I see the divide there at the English Channel. Now you go to Ezekiel 38 and 39, and it says, Gog and his allies come against Israel, but over here on the other side, there's Sheba and Dedan, just drop that for a moment, and the merchants of Tarshish. Tarshish is far west. And the young lions of Tarshish. Now, who's the old lion?
England.
The old British lion. That's England. The young lion?
U.S.,
Canada, Australia, us colonies, yeah. And so, I think that's together. Now, I see that after the Second Gulf War. I see America and England and allies and the Commonwealth on one side, and I see France, Germany, and Russia on another side. The divide is at the English Channel. Now, we'll see. We'll just keep our eyes on this, and we'll see. We need some perspective. But I kind of think that maybe that's where the divides are going to come. I actually don't expect the United States to be militarily advanced against Israel. But I think they're going to be too weak to go in. After all, I thought when we went through the Vietnam War, America learned its lesson. But that memory only lasts for so many years. And then the Gulf War comes up, and there was a spectacular success. I still remember Bush 1 coming in for a State of the Union message, you know, on television, and they all applauded. The war, the accomplishment has been done. The war is over, and a big applaud, you know. I think Vietnam kind of diminished into memory right there. But now we're in Iraq number 2, and now I don't see that applause, that great triumph. Now in Afghanistan, you know. Oh, okay, now Israel's at trouble. You've got France, Russia, and and Germany, you know, on one side, think America is going to say, we'll take you on. Or will they say, okay, I'm sorry, Israel, you know, good luck. But we just can't do this. And I think that's what they'll say. Are you come to take the spoil? But that's all they say. They don't do anything in Ezekiel 38. Just that coalition says, well, what are your intentions here? And I think that's why Israel is going to be left defenseless, except, of course, for the strongest defense in the whole universe. But that's from above. But Cheryl, what were you going to say? Okay, Jeff?
I've always been wondering why Afghanistan and Iraq were not mentioned in that Ezekiel 38 coalition. I'm wondering if it's because of their current situation now, after the fact.
That may be, because if Iraq basically is taken out of the situation because of America's involvement, and Afghanistan just kind of weak, and that's a very interesting observation. Because Iran is definitely part of that coalition. And even Togarma, Turkey. Now, Turkey is taking more and more negative toward Israel, even though at one time they were a little more reciprocal. So it's interesting to see how things are shaping in the direction that the prophecy seems to say. We'll keep our eyes on it. There might be some surprises still. Brother Andy?
Just a comment. It's simple. It seems that the news media are showing that Russia, for some unknown reason, is approaching Iran and wanting to support and favor Iran. And it seems... Seems a far-fetched to me.
Now, I've heard people that are more studying this than I am say that Russia and Iran have never been together for centuries. And now, suddenly, here we are at the end, and there's some rapprochement. And, you know, I still remember when Iran was kind of in the sphere of the West, when the old Shah was in power. And then the uprising came in the late 1970s, was it? And now suddenly, Iran has shifted into attraction to Russia and certainly divested of from America.
Right, just quickly, an interesting chess move, some might say.
An interesting chess move, yeah. We'll just keep our eyes and see what's happening. But it looks like it's shaping up in the direction the prophecies say. Okay, so let's see what happens now as they launch out into the storm. Verse 15... and verse 16. Let's read those two. Janice, could you read those for us?
Okay. I'm sorry, what?
15 and 16. This big Euroclidean wind is upon them now. Now it tells us what happens.
So when the ship was caught and could not head into the wind, we let her drive, and running under the shelter of an island called Clauda, we secured the skiff with difficulty.
Now here's Clauda down here. This little tiny island. They come under the protection of Clauda and they say, maybe we can get back in control here. Now, you remember earlier we started off here at a place called Caesarea. The captor was Julius. He was a band of Augustus. You get the idea? Okay, I can see. We're under the power, the rule of the powers that be. Clauda, I presume, is named after Claudius, the Emperor Claudius. And it's telling us this is part of the old world, the old order. Maybe it's telling us this is their last stand to try to recoup some order and control. Get this ship of state back under control. It proves abortive, it doesn't work. But you know, in Revelation, in plague number 6, before Armageddon hits, but they're driven by this difficulty. They've got the financial withering of the Euphrates drying up. Well, let's see what Revelation says they do to try to recover some stability. This is Revelation 16, and let's read verse 13. Verse 12 is when the river Euphrates dries up, that the kings of the east, that would be Cyrus and his band, Christ and his band, might be prepared. Now verse 13. This is what they do as a consequence of the economic withering. Marvy, do you have that for us? This is Revelation 16, verse 13.
Then I saw three evil spirits that looked like frogs. They came out of the mouth of the dragon, out of the mouth of the beast, and out of the mouth of the false prophet.
And let's read another one, too.
They are spirits of demons, performing miraculous signs. and they go out to the kings of the whole world to gather them for the battle on that great day of God Almighty.
Okay. So there's a last stand here. The beast, well, that would be papacy. The false prophet, that's like the two-horned Church of England and her entourage. And then the dragon, that's Satan in his control of political civil authority. They're weak. They've got the Western world is being tormented, tortured by the storm because of the withering of the economies. Now, you know, I wasn't around for the Great Depression, but I hear the generation before me talking about it, and wasn't too good, but society kind of held together. And there was a certain moral fabric that kept things going. They worked their way through it. In the decades intervening from then to now, I think that fabric has pretty much rotted. It's being kept together by welfare payments and all that kind of stuff, you know. But you start really putting stresses on the economy, and I think this fabric begins to start pulling apart. And so the beast, dragon, the prophet, false prophet say, not out of strength, but out of weakness, we've got to lean to each other for a little support here. We need a little moral authority. We need to put our institutions together and hold on. Now, I know that brethren wonder, was it going to be strong, or is it going to be weak, or is it going to be persecuting? Now, I have my opinions about that. Whatever it is, it's coming. It's not past. It's not in the past. It's just as a preceding Armageddon. It's what drives the kings of the earth to Megiddo. Now, you remember back in 1 Kings 22, where you mentioned Micaiah, when Ahab and Jehoshaphat and the 400 false prophets led by a two-horned leader were going to coalesce an alliance to go into battle and be victorious. And Micaiah says, it's not going to work. It's not going to work. Well, I think that's what's referred to here. They have this alliance, and they're going to go into battle. And in battle, they're going to be defeated. And I think this alliance is primarily European, primarily in the Catholic part of Europe. Now, Romania, it's got Catholic there, but it's mostly Orthodox, am I right? Mostly Orthodox. And I really don't know how some of the Middle Eastern countries of Europe are going to fare here, or where they're going to be connected. I really don't know. But when Gog, Russia, and France and Germany, if that's the right coalition, if that's right, when they come together, I think that's the coalition that's referred to here. That's my opinion. I think this is more European than it is America. We'll see. We'll keep our eyes open. But I think they're going to look for some stability. They're going to go into the battle, and that's where they're going to be broken. Remember what Micaiah said? Ahab says, put this man in jail till I come back in peace. And Micaiah says, if you come back at all, I'm no prophet. And I think that's what's going to happen to this coalition. They're not going to come back intact. They're going to be broken. And it says in Ezekiel 38, they will fall, that is, be destroyed, on the mountains of Israel. I think that's the last invasion. Now, I was stymied once back in the old days when I thought the Soviet Union would be intact here. And that was godless Russia, you know, as we thought it. Well, if you look in Ezekiel, you find the description of the destruction of this invading host is the basis for what Revelation chapter 19 calls the destruction of Christendom. Well, how could godless Russia be part of Christendom? I was confused. Robin, my brother, asked this question when we were studying Ezekiel once. Now it's not as confusing. Russia's still there. They're basically part of the old European Christian culture. Now you got communism stripped away, and you got the old underlying nominal Christian culture still there. I think this is part of old European Christianity, and I think that's the coalition, and that the destruction in Ezekiel and the destruction in Revelation 19 is two sides of a coin. That there's two descriptions of the same destruction. I don't think it's America. Yeah, some say, oh, you're just biased. I hope we don't have that a bias in our understanding of prophecy. We just want to know the facts. We just want to know what's going to happen. Randy?
Actually, in Russia, Putin has been financing the feasts, the Orthodox feasts, and trying to revive a stronger interest in the Orthodox Church in Russia.
That is interesting. That old Orthodox cultures is having a resurgence. Yes.
There was a speech given by the new prime minister
And I listened to part of it. And they would have shots of the crowd. And very frequently there was a shot of a gentleman who was dressed in the traditional garb of the priest. And so they were bringing the old system back, the old religious system back in, making sure that they were a part of it, because he was given a favored spot to sit, and the camera would shine on him, you know, fairly frequently while this speech was going on.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's the old Christianity still there.
Yes.
But Dave.
So you would apply the end of 16 and beginning of 17 where they're undergirding this ship as this coalition that comes together? Is that
I think so. Now I'm a little tentative on this, you know, sure. but they're coming. They're going under this island of Clauda for some protection, and they're trying to regain control, and that's where they try to undergird the ship. Now there's 3 days mentioned here. Let's see, we read 15 and 16. We didn't really go down to 17 yet, right?
Before you get to that, though, you know, any thoughts on the, you know, where they just let the ship run? I mean, clearly the ship is just completely out of control. Any thoughts on what that...
Well, that is verse 17, right?
No, that's...
Oh, verse 15. Oh, yeah, we just let it drive, yeah. Well, I think this is talking about when the storm hits, and I don't think we're there yet.
Right.
This storm of real turmoil, it's going to last for 14 days. We'll see that a little bit later. And I think they're just going to have to, what that means is they're going to have to go with the flow of the popular public sentiment and respond as best they can to check the distresses. And it won't be ultimately successful, but they're just going to have to go with the flow of current events and try to manage as they go. And I think this is... They strike sail. Does that mean they pulled the sail down?
Yeah, so.
And just let it drift to wherever it could go. And I think that's the point. They're just going to have to yield to the direction that the masses are going to take them to try to rescue themselves out of this storm. Brother Jeff?
I'm just looking at... No battery power.
Okay. I have to speak loud.
Anyway, I'm looking at one of the New Brunswick newsletters here, and they have a picture of Putin with the leader of the Orthodox Church, the Russian Orthodox Church. He's very much in sympathy with the Orthodox Church. And the book that I was reading earlier, if you had kept reading the quotation, that gentleman had said that the goal of Russia is to rebuild the Byzantine Empire. Mm-hmm. They want all of that land so that Russia can bask in her glory as in the old days.
That's interesting.
Israel was a part of that Byzantine.
That's right. You know, after Rome came under the sway of the Goths and so forth, the second Rome was Constantinople. What I didn't know is that Moscow is referred to as the third Rome, because that's where the center of the Byzantine Empire kind of moved to. And I can see now their attraction to restore the empire that they had before. Interesting. Further out.
There's really two ships involved here. Well, one is a ship and one is a dinghy.
Yes, you're right.
And so what I was wondering is, how does the dinghy... It's really the dinghy that they had trouble controlling. And then they say, well, then they haul it aboard.
Yeah. Al, this is a very intriguing area, and I really am not sure exactly how to distinguish the symbology here. But you're right. There's this little dinghy. I guess they use that for landing vessel or something. And they had a hard time coming by the boat. That's the point, that dinghy. And finally they brought it aboard. There's probably some detail here I'm just not fully fathoming. But it is a good point to notice. Was there another hand up over here? Okay. Brother Randy?
Just the hedge, the possible symbolism, a hedge against some fund or organization which would be useful to the European organization.
Okay. Well, now let's read a little farther, still in the same storm. Verses 17 down through 20. 17 through 20. Claudia, could you read that for us?
After they had hoisted it out,
Excel, 27:17-20. After they had hoisted it up, they used supporting cables in undergirding the ship, and fearing that they might run aground on the shallows of Syrtis, they let down the sea anchor, and in this way let themselves be driven along. The next day, as we were being violently storm-tossed, they began to jettison the cargo. And on the third day, they threw the ship's tackle overboard with their own hands. Since neither sun nor stars appeared for many days, and no small storm was assailing us, from then on, all hope of our being saved was gradually abandoned.
Okay, this went from bad to worse. Now, there's 3 days mentioned in particular here. The first day, they undergirded the ship. The second day, they threw out some tackling with their own hands. Is that what it says? They lightened the ship. Ship's tackle. And the third day?
Tackling.
What was the second day then?
They began to jettison the cargo.
Okay. So they lightened the ship. And the third day, the tackling with their own hands, they began to throw overboard. They're trying to do anything they can just to stay afloat. Now, the reason I noticed in particular that there's 3 days mentioned where things are particularly distressing is because if this represents plague number 6 over here, when the economy tanks and things begin to pull apart and there's real distress and they can't get in control of it, if you go back to the Exodus account, the plague just before the end, what was that plague? It was plague number 9 there.
Darkness.
For 3 days. It mentions
to move.
That's right. They couldn't get out of the house to go about and do their normal business. It was so thick. So there's 3 days back in that corresponding plague in Exodus, I think ties into these 3 days. It doesn't mean that the trouble is only 3 years long, but it means there's a 3 year, perhaps, if a day is a year here, I don't know, maybe. As Jim Parkinson suggested this, and I found it attractive. There might be 3 years of particularly deep depression. We haven't had a depression for a while. Recently, we haven't had a depression. It's been a severe recession, perhaps. But now we're advancing towards something really bad. Now, remember, we haven't yet come through the billows. We haven't yet come to Fair Haven. We haven't come to the time when the high calling begins to close down. All that's ahead of us. So this 14 days of storm, we haven't encountered yet. Society is still pretty placid, even if they're not happy. But when we hit that point, it says maybe we have 3 years of difficult depression. Now we'll see when we get there. We're just projecting. We'll see. Keep our eyes open. We may have to adjust a few things. But this is a roadmap, I think. And you know, God can't write a book, but he didn't. It wouldn't be wise to write a book and explain exactly in detail just everything that's going to happen in sequence and time frame and everything. If you want the brethren to know, you've got to put that in code language. And here's code language. And if the code becomes clear, as the time becomes clear. So I think that's where we have to keep our eyes open, see what's going to happen here. Jeff?
How many days is it until Fair Haven?
We're not told. We're just told a considerable time passed at Fair Haven. And here it was slow going for a long time. They barely passed Salmone. We're just not told specific numbers of days. Now that we've got some dates on the board here, I'm going to go back and just make a suggestion. That we have, here we have 40 years. Here we have 14 to 45, that would be 31 years, right? And here we've got 45 to 89, 44?
Yeah.
44 years, okay. So if we add these two, we've got a total from 1914 of 75 years that's transpired. Well, I just noticed, that's all, I just noticed, that up to the Lord's return, we had from 1799 to 1874, how many years involved there? 75, same number as years here. Not the same time dates. The same period of time. Now you come up to the first expectation for the Lord's return, the Miller Movement, 1843. How many years do you have to wait until the Lord really did return in 1874? 31. So I'm seeing these same spans that we come up later are matched with the time spans we had before the harvest. The time spans during the harvest match those that we had leading to the harvest. All that's telling me is maybe that's coincidence. Could be. It's not just a few numbers. But if it's meaningful, it's telling us that we're on the right track by using these dates to mark these episodes in the Elijah experience. So it's just a little bolster to say maybe we're on the right path because we see a pattern here. It's not real strong. But thereafter, I don't know that we're... I don't think we can put a date on this. We'll see. When we get there, maybe we'll say, okay, that appears clear, and then we can put some years on it. We'll see when we get there. Now, we do have these 3 days, and then we have the fact that the entire storm lasts for 14 days. We'll see that in the verses coming up. Meanwhile, it says, verse 20, when neither sun nor stars in many days appeared, well, put this in other language. The moon has turned to blood, the stars of heaven withdraw their shining, and there's darkness there. That's Matthew 24. The stars of heaven stop shining, the sun is darkened, the moon turned to blood. In other words, we're at the crescendo of events that are right leading to Armageddon. And this is the storm that takes you to Armageddon. Armageddon crash is going to happen on the island of Melita. That's coming up. Now, they avoid the quicksands down here in the north shore of Africa.
Three minutes?
Okay. So they avoid this, and I don't know what that refers to directly. It says some seems to indicate that there's some jeopardy that they avoid. Maybe we won't know until we get there. But we can keep our eyes on various developments as this proceeds. So where are we now? Well, if Armageddon ends with the crash of the ship, and if 14 days before that represents 14 years, now maybe it doesn't. Maybe it's just a double seven, which elsewhere in Scripture does lead to the kingdom. I won't dilate on that because our time is short. But if it's 14 years, then back up whenever you think Armageddon's coming, 14 years, now I have a date, everybody knows I have a date for that, and I'm not going to push that here, but in my mind, I would back up 14 years from that, and I would say, okay, well, that would be 2029, something like that. Add 2029-14, you get to whatever I think is going to come. So today we're at 2010. That means the storm is going to start in 2029. Well, we'll see when we get there. Now, if it doesn't happen, then we'll say, okay, maybe it's not 14 years, it's something else. But you got these roadmaps on the way to at least look at and check. But before that happens, well, no, at the beginning of that happens, then we're going to see 3 years of particular difficulty. And, you know, World War I was, what, 4 years? World War II was 6 years? And I think that shook the world, but not everybody began to say, Lord, save us from everything. It wasn't dynamic enough. But what about 14 years where society really begins to pull apart and things begin to fail? Will that be enough to make men quail and look above for some relief? You know, they say in war, in the foxhole, there's no atheists. Because when you're really under dire distress, you say, God, save us and help us. And even we're succumbed to that. I mean, we have trials, we look up above, and we should. But I think the world maybe will turn their attention to the Heavenly Father during this time. 14 years might be the right appropriate situation for a total stress and difficulty. And you know what it says, you know, in Luke, men's hearts failing them for fear, because they don't just see how this is going to work out. I don't think yet the hearts of men are failing for fear quite. I don't think so. But here in verse 20 it says, when neither sun, stars appeared in many days, no stalter, all hope was lost. That's men quailing for fear. And that's when, finally, man's extremity will be God's opportunity. And that's when he can bring them a relief. But first comes the crash of the ship. Now, we're going to stop here, and we'll pick up the
quarter after. So we got a half an hour.
Half an hour?
I don't know. Do we want to sing a hymn? Well, I mean, if the food's ready when it's ready.
Okay. Well.
So what do we want to do?
I don't mind continuing.
Okay, so then let's just continue going.
Okay, we're almost there to the crash. I like to at least get to the crash.
And then, the other thing, Brother David, I'd like to see us put the date in, whatever date that is, 2043, and then back up. You know, we got one half. Maybe we can come back with the other half. We got 3 days and kind of see,
Okay, well,
but we can do that, I mean, as you're going.
No, well, I kind of did that verbally. I don't want it to splash it on the board and throw it in everybody's face, you know. But if you back up 14 years from there, it's about 2029, if I'm doing my mental arithmetic right. So that means we got
today's
2010, we got 19 years, two decades to go of before this storm hits. Now remember, the fast is past, and the high calling, if that's what it means, begins to wind down a little before that, and then they launch out to get a cough from the storm. Maybe that's about the same time. In practical terms, you know, there's a lot of work going on in Africa, in India, and in the third world generally. We got maybe two decades left for the push for this kind of work before the high calling begins to wind down. In practical terms, this means something to me. I mean, I'm involved in this work in Africa and in the third world. And I'll tell you, it's exploding out there. I mean, we've got now like 6-7 people in just Kenya, about 5 in Uganda, that are going out leading seminars of 100, 200, 300, 400 people. Well, I think we had just in the month of November, we had something like 6, 7, or 8 seminars with hundreds of people. And every time somebody attends, a pastor, he wants a seminar in his city, and we're having to defer the request. There's so many. Well, could this continue into the other nations of the third world? In other words, the next two decades could be rife with opportunity. And if we see we only have a couple of decades left, well, it's a push to get going and follow through on this. I that's what it's mean. So this is very meaningful to me. Now, there were some hands up, but I don't see them now. Claudia?
I'm here to talk about the 14 years.
14, okay, we never really got to that verse, but if you look down here in verse 27, when the 14th night of this storm, on a cloudless, you know, on a dark, moonless night, was come, we were driven up and down in Adria. About midnight, the shipmen dreamed that they drew near to some country. That tells us that the storm endured for 14 days before the crash. Maybe that's 14 years before Armageddon. Maybe not. Maybe it's just a double seven. It's symbolic, but not a day for a year. We'll see. Dave?
Yeah, wouldn't that be 14 days the night before the crash? So 15 total?
Okay, maybe. Back up a year.
Okay.
Well, let's make our way through this then. All hope is lost. Now, in verse 21, Paul is going to speak a second time. And let's read verse 21. Gabriella, would you read that for us?
Verse 21?
Yes.
But after long abstinence, Paul stood forth in the midst of them and said, "Sirs, you should have hearkened unto me, and not have loosed from Crete, and to have gained this harm and loss."
Oh, and another one. As a matter of fact, if you could read down through verse 24. 25.
Okay.
26.
"And now I exhort you to be of good cheer, for there shall be no loss of any man's life among you, but of the ship. For there stood by me this night the angel of God, whose I am, and whom I serve, saying, 'Fear not, Paul, thou must be brought before Caesar, and lo, God hath given thee all them that sail with thee. Wherefore, sirs, be of good cheer, for I believe God that it shall be even as it was told me. Howbeit we must be cast upon a certain island.'"
This is a message of the church during the extremity that the world faces. I think there's going to be an opportunity. I think there's going to be some hearing ears out there. And there, all hope is lost, and now somebody comes on the scene that says, "Don't worry, it's all going to turn out all right. There'll be nobody lost. Everybody's going to be saved." Well, how do you know? Well, how do we know? How do we know the kingdom is coming, and indeed the whole world will be saved through this? We know, not because we figured it all out, but because there was an angel that told us. And that was the seventh angel of Revelation. He visited us, and he gave us this message, and I think we believe it. As Paul says, "I believe what I heard was right, and even it's going to be that way." So we have a message of hope in a dark world. They're not ready for it right yet. We've given out as much as we can, but they're still not ready to listen. But when all hope is lost, then maybe a sparkle of hope, it's time for the church to give another message. Not for the high calling. Because I think the high calling is closing down at this point. But even when it closes down, there's still people out there with spiritual minds, I think. And we'll get to that a little bit farther, more advanced here in the lesson. But
The high calling opportunity for fresh inductees, I think, will be over at this point. It'll be a message of hope for the kingdom. Now, is that the Elijah message of the smiting of the Jordan, the last message of the Elijah class? Maybe. I'm partial to that thought. I have a lot of thoughts swimming around that seem to be congealed, but I'm open to persuasion, you know, on all of this. We're still looking and thinking as we go forward to all of this. But that's, I think, the burden of his second speech. He knows there's hope and everybody will be saved. The 14th night was come. We were driven up and down the Adriatic Sea at midnight. At midnight, the shipmen knew that they were in jeopardy. It may sound good. There's land in sight. That's great. Not in sight, but they could see it because they sounded with sounding depths. But this brings trepidation because you're going to crash on this island. Midnight is the hour of jeopardy. Now, go back to the Exodus account. There were 10 plagues. At what time of day did plague number 10 strike? Midnight. That's the same in Revelation as plague 7. That's Armageddon. This, the midnight hour, is the hour of jeopardy. Armageddon is now approaching. At the end of the 14 years of difficulty in plague 6, now we're approaching the midnight hour of the final decisive issue. Now, I think we're already in plague 6. For a long time, I didn't know that. I didn't think we were because I haven't seen the beast, dragon, and false prophet coalesce. But I think plague number 6 is broader than that. It's the drying up of the Euphrates that produces that consequence. We're seeing the gradual withering of the Euphrates now. We're seeing the withering of the Western economies. I think we've been in that ever since at least 2000, when the first billow, the market collapsed, and now the second billow. Now we'll see what else comes ahead of us. So now with perspective, I think we've been in plague 6 for some time. When the Soviet Union began to crumble in 1989, I thought at that time, and other brethren did too, that's the end of plague number 5. That's the end of the plague on the seat of the beast, where the communist doctrines had come across Central and Middle Europe, where there was strong papal ground, and they kind of withered, taken away all economic prosperity, eaten up every green thing, and then it says in Exodus, that plague of locusts that came in, ate up every green thing, was pushed back by a strong western wind. The strong western wind of the western economies and culture has pushed those communist doctrines back. And I think by 1989, New World Order, I think plague number 5 ended. So now plague number 6 is impending. 10 years later, I think it begins to hit in the year 2000 or so. 2001. And with the market collapse. So I think we've been in plague 6 for a while, but we're not to Armageddon yet. Plague 6 is a long, withering process, and it's to be extended. So now in verse 27, they come to jeopardy. They sounded. They found 20 fathoms. They went a little further. They found 15 fathoms. I think those numbers have meaning, but I'm going to pass over that for just now. Verse 29, then fearing lest we should have fallen upon rocks. Well, let's pick up the thread there. Brother Dick, could you read for us, starting with verse 29, and 30, 29 and 30.
27.
Yes.
Then fearing lest we should have fallen upon rocks, they cast 4 anchors out of the stern and wished for the day. And as the shipmen were about to flee out of the ship, when they had let down the boat into the sea under color as though they would have cast anchors out of the foreship.
Can you read 2 more as well?
Paul said to the centurion and to the soldiers, except these abide in the ship, ye cannot be saved. Then the soldiers cut off the ropes of the boat and let her fall off.
Okay, now notice the way it's worded here. They cast out 4 anchors. I remember Brother Ray Luke's talk long ago. He says, the 4 winds are beginning to blow. They have to stabilize society, throw out the 4 anchors. I think that connects. I think the 4 winds do blow at Armageddon, and I think they're trying to stabilize this institution. That's why the 4 anchors thrown out the stern. Somebody wants to abandon ship here. There's got to be a point to this. And I think the point here is it demonstrates that while it's rough going out there, and we may not be real pleased with all the decisions made by the political leaders, it's better than nothing. And, you know, as Paul says, pray for them that we might live decent and peaceable lives and so forth. Well, here, if they just abandon the political leaders, they just say, whatever happens, happen. It's going to be worse off, and they might not get through the storm intact. But they've got to do the best they can. And by doing the best they can stave off some of the disaster that would otherwise come. And I think this tells us we should have respect for the political leaders and their authority and what they're trying to do. And if somebody said, okay, it's time for Bill Dutka to take the reins of authority and tell us all what to do, well, I'd listen with interest. He's very sharp. But I'm not sure any one of us has the knowledge of exactly how to control this issue. We know the big picture, but I wouldn't know what to do exactly in the storm. So I'd just say what this passage says, these people guiding the ship better stay on board. If they abandon ship, it's going to be worse off. We might not get through this thing. So we're thankful for whatever leadership does what they think they can do to try to stave off problems. And if I think they make the wrong decision here or there, I'm probably wrong. You know, they're probably right. They know more than I do. But whatever it is, they need to do the best they can to take us through this storm. And it's going to be better for everybody collectively if they do. So this abandoned ship was aborted. Verse 33. Let's go on a little farther to see. Brother John, could you read for us verse 33 down through verse 38?
And until the day was about to dawn, Paul was encouraging them to take some food, saying, today is the 14th day that you have been constantly watching and going without eating, having taken nothing. Therefore, I encourage you to take some food, for this is for your preservation. For not a hair from the head of any of you shall perish. And having said this, he took bread and gave thanks to God in the presence of all. And he broke it and began to eat. And all of them were encouraged, and they themselves also took food. And all of us in the ship were 276 persons. And when they had eaten enough, they began to lighten the ship by throwing out the wheat into the sea.
Okay, so now Paul speaks again. This is the third time Paul is going to speak on this voyage. Now, remember the midnight hour. Midnight hour is when the death angel passed over and the firstborn were smitten of Egypt. What happened to the firstborn of Israel? They were passed over. I think that represents the church. Passed over from death to life. The church just goes home at this point. That means Paul no longer represents the church. The church is gone. And yet Paul's still there and he has a message. I think Paul now represents the next class that is anointed by God as his spokesman. Now, in the Elijah picture, when Elijah went up in the blaze of glory, his mantle dropped back to earth. He didn't take that up with him. Who picked it up and used it?
Elisha.
Who does Elisha represent in this great company, is the usual thought. I favor that. I think that's correct. I think that great company picks it up. Where is this great company? Well, in my opinion, I think great company is in two places. It's here, and but I think it's also out there. I think prophetically, the picture of the great company in their last effort is really out there. That's my opinion. I think that's when they rise up out of their bed too late. They realize they've lost something. They go out looking. They come to the keepers of the city. They're wounded. They smite them. They go beyond that. They come to the daughters of Israel, and they say, have you seen my beloved? And the daughters of Israel say, the Song of Solomon, chapter 5, what's so special about your beloved? You say, oh, well, let me tell you about him. And they go on to this great description of how beautiful and gorgeous he is. And the daughters of Jerusalem, I think Israel, say, whoa, I'm impressed. Where is he that we may seek him with you? And then, surprisingly, that woman seems to know where he is. She says, well, I know where he is. He's gone up to his garden. His garden in Song of Solomon is a metaphor for the bed of love. In other words, he's there with his bride, and I'm here. I've missed it. And I think the great company wakes up, and they realize things are happening that are different than I expected. The harvest is past. The summer has ended. I don't feel good about this. I've missed something somewhere. But they rouse up, and the great company has a message. To Israel, I think that's in Song of Solomon, they encourage Israel to look to their Messiah. Now, Ken Rossin is doing a nice work with Israel, but he's not doing this work with Israel. He's not telling them, look to your Messiah. In fact, he avoids that point. We're not to that time yet. They're not ready for that yet. But when the nations are ready to come against Israel and they have no friend, then maybe it's time for them to think, oh, you know, who can help me? You know, tell me more about this Jesus. And I think there will be a class in Christendom that is quite ready to explain to Israel who is their Messiah and what they should do about it. And I think there's the people out there in the churches that are ardent and adamant. Remember, I think the church is gone by this point. I think the Great Company is left. Well, the Great Company has two messages, one for the Christian world, one for Israel. For the Christian world, that's what we're seeing here, Paul's message. And he says this. He doesn't go into dissertation about the divine plan. He doesn't say what he said earlier. Earlier he said, I happen to know that everyone's going to be saved. And an angel told me that. That's what the church knows. Great Company out there, they haven't heard that good news. The Great Company says, all I know is this. You haven't really had much spiritual nourishment recently. No bread. The bread from heaven, that's our Lord Jesus. You haven't really had much nourishment here. I advise you, take some bread and eat it. You need some strength. And Paul breaks bread. He blesses it. They all take courage. They begin to have some bread. They begin to look above. They look, I think the Christian world looks up above to God to provide some remedy for this. I think that's the last message of the Great Company. Elijah comes back and he smites the Jordan the second time. There's the message. There's the second testimony of Paul. And now we're ready for the conclusion. And so it's, oh, well, the number of souls in the ship. Is that what you're going to ask?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's so specific. So specific. 276. Well, I think there is a meaning to it. You know, I think this is a number that takes you back to the flood. How many years were there from Adam to the flood in volume 2? Does anybody know the number? 1656. Okay. And so I think this number is related to that number, and it's going to take us to the what the flood means. Remember, Jesus said that in the days of the presence, parousia of the Son of Man, they won't know. They'll be marrying and giving in marriage until the flood comes and sweeps them all away. And then they say, oh, now we know. That's the crisis. That's the Armageddon. That's the apocalypse. Well, that's what the flood takes you to, this crash landing and this destruction of the ship of state. But it's not the people in the first millennium that are going to see this. It's not the people in the second millennium that are going to see this. It's not the people in the third millennium. It's the people at the end in the sixth millennium that see this. Well, if you multiply that number by 6, you get 1656. I think that's the number of people representing those in the sixth millennium for the kingdom impending. It does fit numerically, and I think it's meaningful that this is a little token of the world population at the end before the kingdom comes and the flood sweeps away the institutions of the world. That's my thought on the number anyway. Now let's go a little farther. I want to finish this out if we can. When they ate, they lightened the ship and cast the wheat, the grain, into the sea. Now, do you remember in Joseph's time, you have 7 years of plenty and 7 years of famine. What did the 7 years of plenty represent? It may seem counterintuitive, but what did the 7 years of famine represent? Two ages in the divine plan. Anybody have a thought? 7 years of plenty, 7 years of a famine.
Plenty is the gospel age, that's and the famine is the kingdom.
That's it. Seems counterintuitive, but in the gospel age, that's when men seem to have all they need. They don't need luck. By the time the kingdom comes, they've spent everything they could think of for their own redemption, and they're in need, and they begin to turn to Pharaoh, Jehovah, and say, give us some grain, we need. So I think the throwing of the grain overboard is showing now they have no grain. We're into the 7 years of lack of grain, as it were, where they have to come to the Heavenly Father for it. Maybe just a tie in there, perhaps. Okay, let's go to the last scenario, verse 39 through 44. And then we're going to end with that, 39 through 44. Let's see, who can we get to read? Lizette, I don't think I've called on you. Are you? Would you like to read, or are you? This is Acts 27, verses 39 through 44.
And when it was day, they knew not the land, but they discovered a certain creek with a shore into the which they were minded, if it were possible, to thrust in the ship. And when they had taken up the anchors, they committed themselves unto the sea and loosed the rubber bands and hoised up the mainsail to the wind and made toward shore. And falling into a place where two seas met, they ran the ship aground, and the forepart stuck fast and remained unmovable, but the hinder part was broken with the violence of the waves. And the soldiers' counsel was to kill the prisoners, lest any of them should swim out and escape. But the centurion, willing to save Paul, kept them from their purpose, and they commanded that they which could swim should cast themselves first into the sea and get to the land. Then the rest, some on boards and some on broken pieces of the ship, and so it came to pass that they escaped all safe to land.
Okay. So the day breaks. I think this is the new day of the kingdom. And they say, okay, we're trying to get to land here. They find a little place where they think they can make an inlet into the land. It's a place where two seas come together. Maybe two conflicting surges of mankind coming together at this little island. I think that little island is Israel. We'll talk more about that when we get to the next chapter later. But that's where the ship of state is going to stick in the sand. The waves keep pounding on the back and break up the ship. The ship is lost. That's gone. I think that's the ruin of the present governments. And every man overboard for himself. They all swim to shore, some on planks, some swimming, wherever they can. And they finally make it to shore. Everybody saved, just like the angel told Paul it would be. Showing that the world of mankind will all be saved in the kingdom. Doesn't mean there will be no carnage in Armageddon. There will. But prophetically, everybody will ultimately be saved. Maybe we can talk a little bit more about this. Lizette, did you read in verse 40? They loose the what?
Bands.
Rubber bands. Yeah, I guess they're rubber bands to keep the ship a sail. Yeah, this is when I always used to read it that same way too. If you look very carefully, Lizette, what is that word for instead of rubber? What does that say? Rudder, yeah, I know. Sounds better as rubber bands to me. But they loosed the bands holding the rudder, and they went to shore, and the whole ship breaks apart. This is the Armageddon crash. I think we're going to stop here, and we'll pick up a few details on this when we resume next time. But thank you, and turn back to Brother Bell.